Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. Today, the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group is hosting a discussion on Miranda warnings for terrorist suspects, including enemy combatants. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. I'm Richard Klingler, a partner at Sidley Austin, and I'm pleased to welcome our podcasters for this discussion, recorded on January 21st, 2011. Joining us are two professors from the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. Professor Paul Cassell teaches criminal law and procedure and served in various positions within the U.S. Department of Justice and as a federal district judge. Professor Amos Giora also specializes in criminal law and procedure and served for nearly two decades in the Israel Defense Forces in various senior legal positions. We'll hear first from Professor Cassell.
Thanks very much, Richard, and I appreciate the Federalist Society sponsoring this discussion, and I look forward to continuing a discussion that Professor Giora and I have had for a number of months now on the role of Miranda warnings in international terrorism investigations. I'm going to be making reference to some PowerPoints along the way, so if you've got those in front of you, you may want to turn to the first slide there, where I talk about a particular terrorist case so we have some context for our discussion. You can see basically that our alleged terrorist here, I suppose I should say actually our terrorist, Mr. Abdul Matalam, started out in Yemen, and then he went to Guyana, Nigeria, the Netherlands, and on Christmas Day of last year, flew from Amsterdam to Detroit with the intent of blowing up a Delta aircraft with hundreds of people on board. Now, fortunately, the plan was thwarted, as we all know. The passengers were able to land safely. But then the question becomes, how should Abdul Matalab have been handled in the investigation? And let me just throw out my understanding of the investigation, and Professor Giora can amplify that if he has a different understanding. But turning to the next slide here, this is my understanding from press reports of what happened. Abdul Matalab spoke openly to FBI agents in his initial 50-minute interrogation, questioning that was taking place before he was Mirandized. He then got treatment for burns he'd suffered while trying to detonate his bombs, and 5 hours after his initial interrogation, a second team of interrogators was brought in to question him. Those interrogators were part of a clean team brought in to interrogate him after he was read his Miranda rights. So they began reading him his Miranda rights and being advised of his right to remain silent. He chose to exercise it. So those are the facts that we have, and I want to argue that that was not the proper way in which to question Abdul Matalab. It's not the proper way to question people who are reasonably suspected of being involved in serious terrorism enterprises. Let's talk a little bit about what the Miranda warnings require, and more broadly, what the Miranda procedures require. I think there's sometimes a misunderstanding based on Law and Order episodes or something like that. The Miranda's just a matter of reading a few words off a card, and what's the big deal about that? But if you turn to the next slide, you can understand that Miranda procedures involve more than just the famous four-part Miranda warnings. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you. You have the right to an attorney before answering questions. And if you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you. In addition to that, there is what's called the Miranda waiver requirement. Police officers have to ask the suspect something along the lines of, look, understanding what your Miranda rights are, do you wish to answer my questions? And if the suspect says no, then that's the end of the game. No more questioning is allowed. The officers essentially have to fold up the tent and go home. And that's exactly what happened, of course, with Abdul Matalab. This is what I call the mother may I rule of police questioning, like the old children's game. The police have to ask permission, and sometimes they don't get it. Now, does this make sense when we're talking about terrorist investigations? I would submit that it doesn't, and if you turn to the next slide, you can see another person who agrees with me, media commentator Stuart Taylor, I think a fairly centrist, middle-of-the-road, reasonable person, has said, no reasonable person could doubt that starting out with you have the right to remain silent is not the way to save lives. Yet this is essentially the policy into which the Obama administration has locked itself by insisting that it did the right thing when it read Abdul-Muttalib, the would-be Christmas Day bomber, his Miranda rights after only 50 minutes of questioning and a hospital visit. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what Professor Ghiori's take on this, but my sense is, and I think common sense would tell us, this is not the way that you're likely to get the most cooperation, the most information from someone. You're in effect encouraging them not to talk, and of course we know that that's exactly what happened with Abdul-Muttalib. Now, how often does this happen as a statistical matter? Is it true that suspects waive their Miranda rights in some cases? Yes, it is, and if you go to the next slide, you can see my research on this subject. I think I've got some of the best data published in the UCLA Law Review back in 1996, where I was able to document that it is true about 80% of Miranda suspects who are Mirandized waive their rights, but maybe 18 to 20% invoke their rights. So we're talking about roughly one out of every five suspects who's going to refuse to allow questioning of any type. How else might Miranda reduce interrogation effectiveness? Well, here again, I suppose there could be competing points of view on this, but if you go to the next slide, you can find a couple of other folks who agree with me that this is going to impair police effectiveness, law enforcement effectiveness. Here, for example, is Attorney General Eric Holder, who back in 2002 said it would be hard to interrogate John Walker Lynn, the so-called American Taliban, now that he has a lawyer and now that he's here in the United States. That simply makes sense. Once there's an attorney, questioning is blocked. And with Miranda, we offer the right to an attorney even before indictment. And again, that presents the possibility of a suspect like Abdul-Muttalib blocking any interrogation at all. Similarly, here's another quote. The government can't run an interrogation with defense attorneys present, so argues Michael Ratner, a Guantanamo detainee lawyer. So you can see that I think there's a fairly compelling case that providing Miranda warnings to suspects will, as it did in the Abdul-Muttalib case, make it hard to get information. Do we have to do that? I suppose if you could argue, well, this is simply a matter of constitutional right and there's no choice, then the debate could be short-circuited and we wouldn't have much to discuss. But it's pretty clear that Miranda warnings need not be administered in the circumstances such as were present in the Abdul-Muttalib case. And on the next slide, I've put up a quote from New York versus Quarles. That's a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 1984 that recognizes that in situations where public safety is involved, police officers need not administer Miranda warnings. The reasoning is that Miranda is simply a prophylactic device designed to safeguard constitutional rights, but it's not itself a constitutional right. The Constitution itself doesn't list Miranda warnings, and so police officers are free to deviate from that in circumstances where public safety is involved. Well, if you go to the next slide, you can see the answer to the question that I think folks must be wondering at this point. All right, if you can dispense with Miranda in a public safety situation, what kinds of situations are public safety situations? Well, the Quarles case itself provides one illustration. In that case, Quarles had ditched a handgun somewhere at an empty grocery store about midnight, and the cops were trying to locate that gun so it wouldn't pose a safety risk to consumers that came into the store the next day. There are some other cases that have looked at the same kinds of issues. U.S. versus Webster, a Fifth Circuit case out in 1998, said that if police were doing a pat-down of a suspect and they worried he might have needles in his pocket, they didn't need to give Miranda warnings. State versus Ramirez is an Arizona Supreme Court case where police were allowed to enter an apartment, find a body, and then asked what happened and whether others were hurt without delivering Miranda warnings. An Ohio appellate court decision, In re Travis, allowed police to dispense with Miranda warnings where they were responding to a report of gunshots. They saw smoke and heard hissing sounds, and then they questioned the suspect about the possible bomb and what it might be made of. Dice versus State, a Wyoming Supreme Court case from 1992. In that situation, police arrested a burglary suspect inside a building with a broken window and asked whether others were involved in the crime. Now, all of those, I think, establish the general point that even for situations as trivial as trying to figure out whether the suspect had needles in the pocket or whether others were involved in a crime, the police didn't need to deliver Miranda warnings. It seems to me, a fortiori, when they're involved in a situation where the lives of hundreds of people might be at stake, either from an ongoing terrorist operation or a terrorist operation in the future, they could dispense with Miranda warnings. And indeed, there's a case, moving on to the next slide, that involves exactly the sort of terrorism scenario that we're discussing today. That's the case of U.S. versus Khalil out of the Second Circuit in 2000. In that case, the New York police captured an Arab terrorist who wanted to kill as many Jews as possible, and they also seized bombing materials and pipe bombs. Unmirandized questioning of how the terrorists were making the bombs and about disarming the bombs was allowed. And it seems to me that's exactly the kind of questioning that we should allow when people like Abdul-Muttalib are apprehended. Now, is that just the view of those who are critics of Miranda or just the view of those who are out at the University of Utah? Let me move on to the next slide and suggest that I think there's fairly broad agreement that this is a reasonable way to proceed. And here I'm going to cite for that proposition none other than Attorney General Eric Holder. Shortly after this whole Abdul-Muttalib situation was discussed in the media, he said, and I'm going to quote here, "We're now dealing with international terrorism. I think we have to give serious consideration to at least modifying the public safety exception to the Miranda procedures. And that's one thing that I think we're going to be reaching out to Congress to come up with a proposal that is both constitutional but also relevant to our times and the threats that we now face." And so the Obama administration, I think, is on board with this conceptually. I'm sure that many Republicans are on board with the idea as well. And I hope that we can, in our discussions today, establish that this is a good way in which to establish the maximum amount of information from those who are apprehended from terrorist investigations.
Thank you, Professor. Professor Giora?
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me on the show and giving me the opportunity to respond to my good friend and distinguished colleague, Paul Cassell. So when I listen to Professor Cassell, and this is the second time we've been through this important debate, what strikes me and what concerns me is what I call the creation and articulation of an exceptions-based paradigm in response to terrorism. And as someone who has had a seat at the counterterrorism table for 20 years during the course of my career in the Israel Defense Forces, where I served as a prosecutor, a judge, and a legal advisor, I have long been concerned about saying to ourselves in the immediate aftermath of a terrorist attack, oh, now we need to create an exception to whatever, be it an exception to detention policy, an exception to interrogation policy, or an exception to judicial policy. It is true, as Professor Cassell tells us, that the Attorney General of the United States, in the immediate aftermath of Abdul-Muttalib's attempt to blow up the airplane a year ago in Detroit, that the Attorney General, for reasons known but to him, suggested that the administration is going to recommend or going to consider recommending not applying Miranda to suspected terrorists. For people such as myself who have been involved in decision-making, and frankly, the highest levels with respect to counterterrorism, to hear the Attorney General of the United States suggest that was extraordinarily disturbing and disconcerting. Professor Cassell, from his perspective, is absolutely correct to quote-unquote hang his hat on the Attorney General's quote and the Attorney General's articulated statement. Here's why I think it's wrong. The Quarles decision from 1984 articulated and established the public safety exception to Miranda. When a policeman now arrests someone who is suspected, perhaps, of involvement in terrorism, there is no reason in the world why the Quarles exception should not apply to the suspected terrorist just as it applies to the suspected criminal. I argue that when the policeman arrests someone, he doesn't really know for sure if this is a suspected criminal or a suspected terrorist. And if we create an exception to the exception, if we broaden the Quarles exception, what we are in essence doing is granting the policeman the power to minimize the Miranda right articulated or minimized by Quarles even more without knowing for sure who that individual is. It's particularly important to note that in speaking to FBI agents, they are not in favor of expanding Quarles in order to minimize the rights of Miranda, saying in essence that when the arresting policeman arrests someone, the Quarles exception suffices. That's on the scene. With respect to what happens in the interrogation setting, for those of us who have been involved in interrogations of individuals suspected of involvement in terrorism, there's no doubt whatsoever that that meeting point between the individual and the interrogator, between the individual and the state, is extraordinarily fraught with tension, fraught with anxiety, and from the perspective of the individual, fraught with danger. The point of Miranda, and I take us all back to the history of Miranda. Miranda wasn't, it didn't come out of the clear blue sky. When the Supreme Court ruled what it ruled in 1966, there was a long history of extraordinary abuses that had taken place in detention centers in the United States, particularly in the Deep South. To take us back to pre-Miranda, to say that the detainee not be granted rights, is to turn back to the dark pages of American history. There is no doubt that individuals suspected of involvement in terrorism pose a danger to America. There's no argument with that whatsoever. But to engage in a rights minimization paradigm, particularly when we don't know what that individual is suspected of, is, I would argue, not only engaging in rights minimization from a legal perspective, but more dangerous than that, it imposes a rights minimization from a policy perspective with no clear boundaries. Having spoken also to interrogators, American interrogators in Iraq and American interrogators in Afghanistan and American interrogators here in the United States, they consistently have argued, and I think rightly so, that one of the most important tools that they can be given by the executive branch are clearly articulated boundaries of investigation, of interrogation. Miranda was the gold standard. 18 years later, in Quarles, the Supreme Court minimizes Miranda by creating the public safety exception. That's something that interrogators have learned to work with, and the contours are clear. To expand that into an unknown boundaries or with unknown boundaries suggests to me that what we are really going to do is to tell interrogators, do whatever it takes by all means necessary in order to gather information from the individual suspected of an involvement in terrorism. By doing so, we are going to potentially, A, leave the interrogators out to dry because there will be no cover for them because there's no limits to what they can do. We are going to not enable the individual or his defense attorney to know what the limits of interrogation are. And just as importantly, judges will not know what are the limits of interrogation. An exception-based paradigm in the aftermath of terrorism is tempting. It's convenient. It's also perhaps politically sellable today, which is perhaps why the Attorney General said what he said. But I would argue that it is precisely in the aftermath of acts of terrorism or attempted acts of terrorism that is exactly when we need to say, stop, let's count to 10. We don't need to instinctively expand exceptions. We don't need to create alternative paradigms. What is in place, what has been articulated by the Supreme Court, is effective, sufficiently protects society, and interrogators are sufficiently skilled, they are sufficiently trained, and they are sufficiently professional to work within the confines of Quarles. So to sum up from my opening statement here in response to Professor Cassell, I look at this from two distinct perspectives. One is the arresting policeman, the policeman in the street who's now arrested someone. He doesn't know if this is a criminal or a terrorist, and to grant him the exception, creating an exception to the exception, potentially puts him in a tough spot because there'll be expectations that he deny rights. So that's problem A. Problem B, in the context of the interrogation setting, to give interrogators the right to deny a core right of Miranda, that's nothing but set interrogators up for enormous problems at the end of the day is not a reflection of American values that we all feel so deeply about.
Thank you, Professor. Professor Cassell, do you have anything that you'd like to respond to particularly?
Well, maybe I could just ask my friend Professor Giora one clarifying question, and then I'd have a couple of thoughts. Amos, I'm wondering, when the FBI went to question Abdul-Muttalib, would you agree that they could have, under Quarles, dispensed with Miranda warnings? In other words, that was a situation that falls under the Quarles public safety exception? I wasn't completely clear
Right. I think that Abdul-Muttalib, at the scene, there's a potentially a public safety issue because one of the important questions there, obviously, is there's someone else with him. Does he have a co-actor, a co-conspirator? In the interrogation setting, once we've arrested him, once we've not brought him to the detention center where it was they interrogated him in Detroit, and once we've confirmed that there's nobody else involved with him, I don't see why there's any reason in the world not to grant him Miranda protections. And I think to engage in the creating the exception to the exception, once the threat has been minimized, if not totally dissipated by law enforcement, is going to set us down this course where we're going to engage in significant rights minimization. And that's what troubles me so much.
Well, let me follow up with that then. I guess maybe where Professor Giora and I disagree a bit is, first of all, what is the scope of current exceptions to Miranda under the Quarles Public Safety Doctrine? And secondly, what is the scope of the threat posed by terrorist organizations? Turning to the first question, I mean, I think Professor Giora is unduly constraining the Quarles exception, and I've tried to cite some cases in my opening remarks that demonstrate that. Quarles extends not just to disarming the immediate threat that happens to be right there, maybe the gun that they found in Quarles, but it extends, as, for example, the Wyoming Supreme Court has held, to finding out whether others are involved in the crime, because if others are involved in a crime, they may be able to continue to come back and harm law enforcement or harm society. And so I think under existing law, there's no question but that the FBI agents that wanted to question Abdul-Muttalib, even after they'd taken him away from the scene, could have continued exploring those topics. And Professor Giora talks about the threat being eliminated, and it's true that once Abdul-Muttalib was taken off the Delta aircraft, he could no longer blow up that particular aircraft. But for all the FBI agents knew, there were others in the process of getting ready to attack other aircraft or an organization out there that was in the position to continue other attacks. So it seems to me very comfortably the questioning of Abdul-Muttalib even later on at the station house would fit into the Quarles public safety exception. So I don't really see this as a situation where we're creating an exception to an exception. We've already got an exception to Miranda, and the only question is how to apply it in the circumstances that are now confronting us as we deal with terrorists like Abdul-Muttalib. And so when Professor Guerra says, well, how is this going to work? How are police officers going to know whether somebody's suspected of terrorism and all that? Those are already the choices that have to be made whenever police officers today decide to dispense with Miranda under the Quarles public safety exception. I mean, let's go back to the Quarles case itself. The New York police there had to decide, do we have a public safety exception? What kind of crime is Quarles going to be charged with? Is this a situation where we need not give Miranda? And I think all the arguments that Professor Giora is making today could have equally been made against the Quarles decision itself. So I think to the extent anyone is quarreling with existing law, it's going to be Professor Giora rather than me. I'm saying is that we need to apply Quarles to this situation.
And if I can just jump in for a second, where Paul and I agree is that Quarles is the exception to Miranda. And Quarles is the exception to Miranda is effective for suspected criminals just as it is for suspected terrorists. Where Paul and I believe, disagree is whether there should be an expansion of that. And I, as someone, again, who is very concerned, always has been, about creating, an exception and then potentially an exception to an exception, I think that's where we disagree, because I would suggest that in doing so, and if we were to implement the exception to the exception, we would have such a profound rights minimization that, again, I think that would be very much contra, not only to the spirit of Miranda, but very much contra to the spirit of American values.
Well, it's becoming, fashionable to say that American values and values of other countries ought to be considered. And so I think one of the things maybe it'd be interesting to throw into the debate at this point is, what would have happened if Abdul-Muttalib was trying to blow up an aircraft in, let's say, England or France? I mean, those are countries that share many of the same values that we have. And I think it's remarkable when you start to look at the Miranda regime that we've created here, that we are much more restrictive in the types of things that law enforcement officers can do than officers can do in other countries. For example, in England, and I have a slide on this in my materials, there is legislation that grants terrorist suspects the right to a legal advisor, but this right can be suspended for up to 48 hours. And even when it's allowed, it can be ordered that the detained suspect is only to receive legal advice in the sight and hearing of a police officer. Similarly, in France, in cases of terrorism, the individual may not consult with an attorney until the 72nd hour after the second prolongation of detention under the procedures they have there. And the criminal suspects in France do not have to be informed of their right to remain silent. So when we're talking about, well, this would be some kind of police state or return to the Dark Ages or something like that, I mean, it would simply make America look a bit more like England or France in the way they handle these extremely serious terrorist suspects. And so I think it's a bit far-fetched to say that this is going to be some great abuse of civil rights if we begin to suspend Miranda warnings in situations where terrorist suspects are being questioned.
But obviously, if I may just jump in, first of all, as Paul well knows, someone who engages academically in comparative research and looking at a number of different countries and a number of different books I've written. That said, the fact that country A applies a particular model doesn't necessarily mean that it's applicable for another country. And Paul's right that England allows, the British allow themselves certain quote-unquote liberties that fortunately we don't do here. And the fact that we don't apply what the British apply, we don't apply what the French apply, doesn't mean that we're in the wrong or they're in the right. But I do believe that, and I go back to what I said a second ago, that the gold standard, as I refer to as Miranda, and Paul knows this well because he's one of the great experts in the field, that there was a reason Miranda was written. There really were these long, long history of extraordinary abuses in American jails. And to have now the exception, an additional exception, strikes me as such a significant rollback that it is, A, unjustified operationally, B, and I think it would raise unnecessary legal difficulties, and C, I just don't think it's particularly practical.
I wonder if I could expand the discussion slightly by introducing the concept of enemy combatant status. And perhaps I can do so by asking you to address whether there are legal and policy reasons that the government should be providing Miranda warnings to a person who falls within the government's view of an enemy combatant and where there's no anticipation of the use of evidence in court. In other words, there's no anticipation of a prosecution.
Do you want Paul or myself to begin?
Do you want to take that one, Amos?
Yeah, I'll take that one.
Like, why don't you go with that?
The question is, where are we arresting the person in your hypothetical? I mean, if we're detaining someone in Iraq, Afghanistan, and who knows where else American armed forces are presently located, I don't think there's any expectation that they would be granted Miranda rights, even though some of them hopefully one day will be brought to trial. I had parenthetically that I understand the President of the United States yesterday reneged on his campaign promise and announced that the hearings in Guantanamo are going to reconvene, something that I just very much opposed to. Here in the United States, when the policeman arrests someone, he's not thinking enemy combatant. He's thinking criminal law paradigm. And so to say that now, if we take Abdulmutallab, when the police or the FBI arrested him or questioned him, I don't think anybody was thinking, this is an enemy combatant. Well, they're thinking this is somebody who's been arrested, who needs to be granted rights and would be brought to trial. But we need to be careful here because the whole idea of the enemy combatant paradigm, problematic as it is, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't apply here in the United States. And to the best of my knowledge, neither the Bush administration nor the Obama administration thought about denying defining someone as an enemy combatant here in the U.S., absolutely with respect to people arrested in Iraq, Afghanistan, and perhaps brought to Guantanamo or held in Bagram or Abu Ghraib or you know, any of the other detention centers. But it's important to note that as far as I know, and maybe Paul has additional information, there's never been talk about applying Miranda to someone detained in Iraq, nor has there been talk about extending Miranda to someone who's going to be brought before a military commission, which, as I say, is going to be reconvened. The narrow question is here, that in terms of what Paul and I are discussing, is the application of Miranda to individuals suspected of involvement in terrorism here in the United States. And one more point before I turn it over to Paul, it's important to note that the executive branch itself can't agree on how to define terrorism. The Department of State, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Defense have three distinct and different definitions of terrorism. One of the problems in creating an exception to the exception is it's really unclear what we're creating the exception to if we can't define unilaterally, uniformly, what is terrorism.
Let me take a stab at a couple of things in there. Amos has been talking a lot today about exceptions to exceptions, and he indicated, though, that he thought there was an exception to Miranda for questioning of suspects overseas. Actually, I think that's a controversial point. A number of American courts have suggested that when, for example, FBI agents are questioning a suspect in regard to an American criminal case overseas, they have to follow Miranda. And so I wonder now if it's not me, but perhaps Professor Giora, that's creating an exception to the exception in the sense that he's willing to say that Miranda need not be complied with when we're talking about questioning suspects overseas. The question then becomes, if we're going to have an exception for overseas, why would we formulate it that way? Why wouldn't we just say, well, what we're thinking about there is there are situations where Miranda really doesn't make sense. And I think when we're questioning someone who is an enemy combatant, and I guess we'd have to figure out how to define that term, it's really not the kind of situation that Miranda was designed to apply to. Miranda was designed to apply to conventional day-to-day domestic police operations, not the kind of thing that was involved in the Abdul-Muttalib case and not the kind of thing that's typically going to be involved in terrorist investigations. So I don't know that we're really creating exceptions to Miranda if we start to say, look, Miranda was designed for one set of police problems and police operations, and it doesn't apply cleanly in another set of law enforcement or investigative operations, i.e. terrorist investigations.
Right. The only response to that before we move on to the next question is that One of the great tragedies of the past 10 years is that we have not narrowly defined the status of individuals we're detaining overseas and where they're going to be interrogated, much less detained, and where they're going to be brought to trial. It is an interesting question whether the 20,000-plus individuals held overseas directly or indirectly by the United States, if they should all have the Miranda rights granted them. That perhaps is something we could discuss at some other point.
I'm sorry, if I could just press you on that. For a case where there's evidence taken overseas through questioning with the intention of using it in a U.S. prosecution, is there or is there not the requirement or need for a Miranda warning?
Right, but what you have to here delineate or distinguish, what do you mean by U.S. prosecution? It's important to go back to the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Then President Bush signed the executive order establishing military commissions. The idea was to bring in front of a military commission anyone arrested, detained in the context of acts of terrorism. In the past 9 or almost 10 years, I believe it's less than 5 people who've actually been tried by a military commission. The whole idea of establishing the military commissions in Guantanamo was to, in many ways, to deny these individuals these basic kind of rights. If, on the other hand, the President of the United States were to announce that the 20,000-plus individuals held worldwide are now going to be brought before Article III courts, and all detainees going forward are going to be brought before Article III courts, that would clearly suggest then, again, in the context of American criminal law as we know it, that Miranda then would apply. But we're in a bind here. There's no better way to put it. President Bush created the military commissions. Presidential candidate Obama promised to end the military commissions. President Obama, 2 days ago, announced the reconvening of the military commissions, which is not to prosecute them in the United States, but to bring them to trial in Guantanamo, which is very much of a rights-less paradigm. So when we talk about U.S. prosecutions, it's unclear to me exactly who we're talking about in terms of the pool of people presently held. If we're going to talk about the future pool, then that perhaps does require us to ask ourselves, are they also going to be subject to a military commission? Or are people who are detained in the future, are we going not to bring them before a military commission, but to bring them before Article III courts? But as far as I know, the President of the United States has consistently and constantly, to my great regret, has ducked the issue and has not stated a clear policy that would ensure the rights of the individuals who we've detained.
I'm wondering if I could springboard off of that for a minute and try to bring the debate back just a little bit to Miranda issues. I mean, I can understand Professor Giora's argument that these military tribunals are a bad thing because they're going to take rights away, and maybe someone who's innocent of being involved in terrorist or or enemy combatant activities is going to be wrongfully convicted or something along those lines. I mean, reasonable people can disagree on that, but I can see where he's coming from. But I want to go back to the Miranda issue for a second here. So how is there a danger to somebody like Abdulmutallab if they don't say, sir, do you mind if we ask you questions? Do you agree to waive your Miranda rights? Suppose everything had unfolded exactly as we know it did, and they just didn't say those few words. What rights have been taken away? What danger is Abdulmutallab placed in? And let's remember that the courts will ultimately review his confession to ensure that it is voluntary. In other words, Professor Giora at some points was talking about abusive law enforcement tactics and things like that. If there are abusive tactics, those are going to be thrown out, you know, whether or not the Miranda warnings are in play. The voluntariness test says that police officers can't do something that renders a statement involuntary, regardless of whether the Miranda rules are or are not in play. So I just really find it far-fetched to say that simply failing to give a few words, do you agree to waive your Miranda rights, is somehow taking away a significant right, creates a significant risk of abuse, or is otherwise something that our society ought to be terribly concerned about in the context of terrorism investigations.
So what Paul is saying, and I would say I have great respect for Paul's perspective, and he's right, reasonable people can reasonably disagree, let's violate your rights. And then the court will say, oh, you know, your rights were violated, and we're going to correct course and correct tack and say, well, we can't admit this and we can't admit that. That strikes me as the absolute antithesis of what Miranda was trying to articulate. That, I think, is the antithesis of the philosophy behind Miranda, was to say, no, we can't say, oh, you know, do whatever you want to do in the interrogation setting, and then the court will you know, throw stuff out and will rule that certain interrogations or confessions are inadmissible. What Miranda tried to do, the whole beauty of Miranda, was to put an end to exactly that approach. But again, as Paul says, reasonable people can reasonably disagree.
Professor Cassell?
Yeah, I guess if I could just respond to that. Miranda, of course, did not put an end to questions of what are legitimate tactics and illegitimate tactics. I mean, if Miranda said we're going to get rid of the voluntariness test and substitute the Miranda test, and I think Professor Giora might have a plausible argument. But Miranda didn't do that. It said we're going to have these warnings and waivers, and then after the warnings and waivers are administered, and if there is a waiver, questioning proceeds, we're still going to apply the voluntariness test. So I guess the piece of the puzzle I'm still waiting to have Professor Giora put on the table, at least from my perspective, is how was saying, Mr. Abdulmutallab, do you agree to waive your rights? That's those 7 or 8 words.
Right.
Why is that so important? I'd like to hear some articulation as to why that's a critical feature of American criminal justice. It's, as we know, not a feature of English or French criminal justice systems. So what is so crucial about those words in the context of a terrorist
investigation? Because when an individual is arrested, exactly as Miranda articulated those rights need to be extended to whoever is detained. The policeman is not going to be in a position to distinguish between category A and category B. And creating these additional categories is, I suggest, exactly what is going to lead to abuses. To say to Abdulmutallab or to Major Hassan in Texas, or to any other individual suspected of involvement in terrorism, whether the guy in Portland or even the guy in Tucson 2 weeks ago, to grant him those rights is essential to begin creating exceptions, with the exception of the public safety exception, or to go beyond the public safety exception. I don't see any operational validity in doing so. If he decides to waive or to voluntarily waive those rights, you know, that's his right. To deny him that right, from my perspective, from an operational perspective, A, in the field, and B, in the interrogation setting, I just don't see any operational reason to do that.
Well, isn't the operational reason that he might say, hey, I'm not going to waive my rights, and then they can't question him? Isn't
just
that
like
a
criminal.
Compelling...
But Paul exactly is a criminal, and when we're in the heat of that moment to say, oh, this guy's a terrorist, oh, that guy's a terrorist, is at the end of the day just going to chip away and whittle away at the very foundation of what Miranda tried to establish, subject to, and you're absolutely right to highlight this and to note this, with the exception of what Quarles said in 1984. To go beyond that, if we don't go beyond that with respect to a criminal, I don't see any reason to go beyond that with respect to a suspected and no more than suspected terrorist. And particularly, as I said earlier, when the executive branch can't define amongst itself what's terrorism, what's a terrorist.
Well, do they need an exact definition? Because there's no definition of who is a public safety suspect. There wasn't some field manual that told the police officers in New York that Mr. Quarles was in a public safety situation when they were trying to find his gun.
And that's why to go beyond that to me makes no sense, because from the Quarles exception, which, you know, you and I can have a long discussion, Paul, at a different time, whether Quarles is right or not right, but that's irrelevant because that's the law of the land. To go beyond that strikes me as just simply unnecessary.
How about going within it, though? I guess maybe we're quarreling on adjectives a bit, because it seems to me if Quarles already says to two random New York police officers who are in a routine firearm situation that they can dispense with the Miranda warnings, why not tell a highly specialized FBI terrorism investigation team that, hey, you're equally in a public safety situation just as those New York cops were? I mean, that doesn't seem to me to be stretching the law at all. That seems to me to be almost an a fortiori situation where they would be operating well within existing doctrine to dispense with Miranda warnings.
As long as it's within the context of Quarles, if that's the, and as that is the law of the land, I'm comfortable with that. Going beyond that, saying that no rights are to be granted and we're going to in no way grant the individual those otherwise guaranteed rights, that is something that I personally would find both objectionable and unnecessary.
So would you have a problem with the CLEAN team having dispensed with Miranda warnings on the grounds that they were in a public safety situation?
Depends, again, how we're going to define public safety and where public safety ends. So in the case of Abdul Muttalib on the plane, I think on the plane there's a public safety play. There's a public safety aspect in play. Totally agree with you.
So explain.
Wait, hang on. We're probably going to disagree where the public safety ends. In the interrogation setting, I don't see any reason to deny him Miranda.
So here, just to not to put too fine a point on it, but 5 hours after they've taken a fellow off an airplane with explosives in his underwear that's tried to kill hundreds of people, and they want to ask him some questions about, gee, are there other people trying to do the same thing right now? Where did you get your bombs? Are there other people deploying other terrorists to do this kind of thing? How is that not the quintessential public safety
right
situation?
I'm happy that we're getting into the line drawing here. 5 hours after Abdul Muttalib has been detained and is now in the warm comfort of the Wayne County Jail in Detroit, Michigan, we're going to disagree on this. The public safety aspect of it, in terms of the exception, is behind us, and it's there he needs to be granted his rights. But we're going to disagree on that one.
I mean, and I guess I'd like to hear a little more explanation. I mean, don't you think that's a situation where, you know, public safety is significantly at risk?
I believe that interrogators, skilled interrogators, FBI interrogators, who by the 5 hours later will have been brought in, are sufficiently skilled at their job to know how to, within the confines of the law, to get the material from the information from the individual in the context of existing law.
Just
in the context of both of our debate, and as Paul knows, I just wrote a law review article exactly in this point, in which I had the great pleasure of citing Paul and his great work. Speaking to FBI interrogators, they very much believe, and they affirm what I suggest, that their skill level is so high that within the confines of the law, they're able to get the information that they need. I immediately add, and I mentioned this in the debate that Paul and I had, based on my experience with interrogators in Israel, Israeli interrogators also say and have consistently said that their skill set, their professional training is sufficient and is high enough level that within the contours of the law, they're able to get the information necessary without a need for, again, the exception to the exception paradigm.
But here we've got an empirical point that you've just made and that I guess people can disagree on. You said FBI agents are sufficiently skilled to get the information under existing law. So, you know, that might be true or that might be untrue. Let's test that empirical point, and let's test it in the Abdul Muttalib case. We know that the interrogators went in there to get more information and what happened. Abdul Muttalib refused to waive his rights, so they could get no information. It makes no difference how skilled they were, no difference how restrained their questioning was going to be. They were blocked from asking any questions at all by the Miranda regime, which they decided to comply with in that particular case. So their skill had absolutely nothing to do with it. They just weren't able to get that information when they wanted it. And I think as a result, it's really hard to argue that Miranda isn't impairing law enforcement effectiveness. There's one clear illustration where it did.
The point of Miranda, and I think we're probably all going to agree with this, is A, to protect the rights of the individual and also to protect society. And the question is, how do you balance it? And I think what Quarles did was took that one step beyond that, and that's a step that I'm comfortable with. To go beyond that is something that I'm uncomfortable with.
Let me just in closing suggest this. I mean, I think Attorney General Holder had it right. We're in an era where terrorists are out there. They're trying to kill hundreds of Americans. They've succeeded in killing thousands of Americans. And so we have to look at innovative law enforcement responses to that problem within the existing constitutional framework. There's a recognized public safety exception that's out there, and I think we need to think seriously about how to apply that into the context of terrorism investigations.
This is Amos Geer. I would just say in conclusion, one, I want to thank all of you for hosting Professor Cassell and myself. It's been a great opportunity. And with respect to the core issue, I would say that Miranda plus the public safety exception articulated in Quarles is sufficient with respect to operational counterterrorism in the United States. To go beyond that is, at the end of the day, nothing more than creating yet another slippery slope.
Great. Thank you both for a robust discussion. We hope you've listened to this, have enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you very much.